This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Kenyre. The Florida legislature passed a bill during the 2019 session that will create an industrial hemp industry in the state. This follows changes in federal law that legalized hemp as an agricultural product, which can be used to create a variety of products, and that some see as a possible new cash crop for Florida farmers to grow. Once signed by Governor DeSantis, and all signs do point in that direction, the new law would create a hemp program in the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. We're going to explore the world of industrial hemp this hour, starting with an update on the University of Florida's industrial hemp pilot project, which kicked off about a year ago. I'm joined by Dr. Zachary Brim. He's an assistant professor of agronomy at the UF IFAS Tropical Research and Education Center in Homestead, and he's program coordinator for the university's hemp pilot project. Dr. Brim, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thank you for your time.
Hey there, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show.
And as always, we invite you, the listeners, to join our conversation with questions and comments. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So let's just start with some ground basics here. Can you talk a little bit about hemp as compared to cannabis, which is what contains the THC? Just explore that difference a little bit for our listeners.
Sure, absolutely. So I'd like to be clear that cannabis is a genus of plant in which contains hemp and marijuana, and cannabis sativa is the species for both of those. So what I'm trying to say is that botanically, industrial hemp and medical marijuana are indistinguishable. Now, the distinguishing feature is a legal one, that 0.3% THC, THC being the compound that's associated with the marijuana high, marijuana being the cannabis sativa that has a THC content above the threshold, and industrial hemp being the cannabis sativa that is below the threshold.
How high would the THC-containing plant be above 0.3? Does it go up to like 10% or just kind of what's the high end of that range compared to the industrial hemp?
Well, I'm hearing reports of somewhere north of 25 or 30%. Certainly with the medical marijuana and recreational industries around the country, the breeding and the industry is pushing that number as high as possible.
Gotcha. Okay. So the two look basically identical. Like if you had right there in front of you, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell by just eyeballing them?
That's right. The only way to tell them for sure is by that chemical test done in a laboratory.
Does industrial hemp flower like a cannabis, you know, like what you, the flowers that people, you know, use for medical purposes or recreational purposes?
It can. Now, if I'm to be clear about the different types of industrial hemp, what we might use them for, we have grain, we have fiber, we have the plant extracts. CBD is the one that folks are most familiar with. The CBD, as it happens to have a similar outcome, similar use as the medical marijuana, will look more similar. We're certainly pulling the flowers, the same floral material in the CBD hemp as we are from medical marijuana. Now, grain and fiber might look a little different based on the cropping system, based on the uses and the habit. Fiber, we're growing a lot of tall and spindly stalks in order to pull the biomass off that. Grain, maybe a little bit something similar to fiber, having a lot of plants in a single area, but they're a little bit farther spaced. We're looking to get some flowers, and of course there has to be males in the population as well. And so if you know what you're looking for, you can see some differences, but that assumes that you know what you're looking for and we understand what the expected outcomes are. If you take a CBD hemp seed and you put it in a field like you would a fiber plant, it might end up looking like a fiber plant. And so really the farmer would be the deciding factor within that distinction. So again, to repeat myself, the only true way that you can know the difference between industrial hemp and marijuana is to to do that chemical test.
Hmm. And we'll get into some of the deeper into the, some of those varieties, because that's what your pilot project is all about. Real quick, hemp has been grown throughout history, right? This is not something that's new. This is something that's old that's being revived.
Yes, whether intentionally grown or cultivated, that starts to get a little bit at the nuance of the ethnobotany. Our best understanding is that it was somewhat a camp follower, where the early peoples who were interacting with cannabis would sort of find a plant that they liked. Maybe it had a good fiber, maybe it had a good grain, maybe it was perfect for those early rituals. They would bring it along and toss some seed back into their middens or areas around their camp that had the nice nutrition, and they so slowly selected those types of hemp for which they were most interested in using it. That certainly goes back thousands of years to the early sort of coevolution of people and plants.
And am I correct in that during the, you know, several hundred years ago when sailing ships were sailing the seas, that canvas was made from industrial hemp?
Well, the sails would have been hemp fibers, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The sails, horse bridles, pretty much any time you were looking for a large supply of sturdy rope, sturdy fiber, sturdy cordage, folks were using hemp. There were many other plants that were available, still are available, that can be used for fiber. Hemp is certainly recognized as one of those ones that were cultivated, that were kept along. One of the things I hang on to is some of the early laws in United States colonialism. Many of those settlers, by way of their contract to come to the United States, would be required to grow some form of hemp, likely for the fiber for the Navy, and they're also required to plant some apple trees. Of course, apple takes many years to put on a fruit, and so in one side, the hemp, they were able to help with the resources of the colonies, and with the other, they were committing themselves to the land.
And then that went away when marijuana became illegal, basically. It kind of just lumped it all in there, so the fiber makers and sail makers had to turn to other plants and other sources of fiber.
Well, you jump forward 100 years or more. Yes, certainly with the Marijuana Tax Act, it made growing hemp for fiber very challenging from a economic perspective. And by that time, there were already alternates, other fibers, synthetic fibers, and there weren't nearly as many sales on ships at that time.
Right, yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's get to your pilot project. For starters, can you outline for us what it looked like at the beginning, what your primary research goals were, and then we'll explore what it's become?
Yes, thanks. So we have three primary objectives for the University of Florida IFAS Industrial Hemp Pilot Project, those being a variety trial, a cropping systems and economic assessment, and the invasion risk investigation. The variety trial being access and testing of as many available varieties of hemp as possible from across those uses, early on with a focus on grain and fiber. The cropping systems assessment is looking at the available infrastructure across Florida for existing farms and farming systems, and seeing how we might adapt those equipment, those farming systems to hemp so that we can give farmers a nice entry into the industry. Of course, that comes along with the economic assessment to make sure that we understand the costs associated with hemp and what it would take to break even given a market value. The invasion risk investigation is one that comes from a standard process that's undertaken at the university and state level. There's an assessment to determine the invasion risk of a new plant to be introduced to the state. Of course, that risk is assessed from the best available information, and if it isn't in Florida yet, then that available information is from around the country, around the world. That assessment at IFAS resulted in a score that's associated with a high risk of invasion. And so we as a university, we as a state, need to understand those impacts as well. So when we bring it in to Florida, we can put it into some controlled environments in a very meticulous way, understand how that assessment before bringing it into Florida might relate to some of the information that we gather as we introduce it.
Gotcha. Okay, so those are the three pillars: testing varieties, looking at cropping systems, and assessing the risk of spreading. What were the regulatory hurdles that needed to be crossed for this project to proceed as far as it has?
So we had to obtain approval at the federal, state, and university level. At the time, the DEA still considered industrial hemp on the controlled substance list, so we needed a registration there in order to import international seeds. The Florida Department of Ag and Consumer Services had a planting permit process by way of the 2017 legislation that was passed in Florida. So we had to obtain those permits for each of our sites in the research project from FDACS. And we also, as this was a new and potentially legally challenging situation for the university to undergo, those laws in place required that we get specific approval from the University of Florida Board of Trustees. We have all those things now.
Everything's been cleared. So this bill it appears that Governor DeSantis will be signing to start a hemp program, how, if at all, will that impact what you're doing? I mean, it seems like the two are hand in hand somehow, sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. The thing that I like to say first to that question is that any move towards the industry, any activity for hemp commercialization in Florida just makes our program more relevant, more important to make sure that we're doing the good science, that we're contributing to the best available information available to farmers, to the industry. Of course, there's a bit of timeline differentiation. For a while, I was saying somewhat fondly that I was living in two universes, one universe set up by the 2014 Farm Bill and one universe set up by the 2018 Farm Bill. We're certainly moving into that second universe where not just this pilot project that we're doing at IFAS, but the hemp industry in the state gets to interact in a more meaningful way. Once farmers are permitted to grow, then we get to do research on their farm. We get to establish our direct working relationship instead of just this sort of first step where the university gets to give it a try, gets to gather as much preliminary information as possible to make sure that the farmers that do choose to adopt early have a clear understanding of what we know and what we don't know. What those risks might be taking on the challenge.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Dr. Zachary Brim. He's an assistant professor of agronomy at the University of Florida's IFAS Tropical Research and Education Center and program coordinator for the university's hemp pilot project. If you have a question or comment you would like to add to our conversation, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So now the pilot project's scope has expanded since launching. Can you explain the things that you've added to it along the way?
That's right. Well, it's been our approach early on to make sure that we are responding to the mandate from the state and make sure that we are responsive to the industry. And we also knew that we needed to be demonstrating some urgency and some agility in order to continue expanding our program to those areas that might be of priority to the future of the industry. So one of the things I mentioned briefly in passing was how our early variety trial was specifically focused on grain and fiber. Now, we hear some folks talking about grain and fiber in the state across the country, but as you mentioned in your introduction, CBD is certainly one of the things that are motivating folks to get involved in the industry. And we've been able to expand our variety trial to include CBD hemp. So we have 21 varieties of grain and fiber hemp, and we have another 24 varieties of CBD hemp that we're going to be putting out into our variety trial. That took some extra access, that took a little bit of extra support financially and through our partners to bring in some of that material. Another way that we were able to expand the program within this regard is to open up another research facility that could accept these high CBD materials, whether they're from seed or from clones, and move through the propagation step. By and large, you take grain and fiber and you direct seed it into the field. The CBD hemp, as it's a bit more costly, a bit more high value per seed, per plant, we've got to make sure that we have that step to care for these plants to keep them healthy on the way out to the field.
Hmm. So you have plants in the ground in exactly how many different places now?
So right now we have plants outside in the ground in two locations, where you're calling me today at the Tropical Research and Education Center in Homestead. And we also have a planting in Alachua County in the Gainesville area. We'll be planting next week, it looks like, in Quincy at our North Florida research location. And then there's two indoor locations as well that's doing the propagation and controlled environments research. And then there's one last location for me to mention, of course, which is in the Gainesville area. That's where they're doing the invasion risk investigation. So all in all, we have six operational locations in our project in various stages of execution at this time.
And can you just talk a little bit about do you have greenhouses where you grow the babies and then you put them out? Just walk through the mechanics of how this works from a agronomist's perspective.
Sure, absolutely. In some ways, I'm doing too many things at once in order to clearly articulate that process. So let me break it up into the two pieces. The grain and fiber is pretty straightforward. We bring the seeds into the state. We have a seed storage location where we're able to keep track of those shipments of our source of seed. And we send those seeds then to our outdoor planting locations, which then take those seeds and put them directly into the ground.
Gotcha.
That's a little bit of a more indirect route for the CBD hemp, whether they come in by seed or they come in by plant material. Those go to our propagation center, where they can take the seeds, put them in trays, or take the plant material and propagate them by rooted cuttings. You basically cut pieces off a bigger plant, and you make many smaller plants. And then we grow up our supply by that propagation process. And from there, from the greenhouse, we are able to send them across the state.
Gotcha.
Of course, there's a whole bunch of interesting steps along the way where we can do science, where we can gather important information. And so each step along the way that we can, we're trying to gather as much of that research as possible.
Exactly. You're doing rigorous data collection all throughout that process, I'm sure. Where do you get the seeds or the clones or whatever the plant material is you were describing?
We are getting it from as many places as possible. The seeds we have from the United States and many international sources, Canada, Europe, and China. The CBD hemp, that's a little bit more specialized, certainly in the United States, and so we're getting that material, again, from as many places as possible. We have sources now in California, Colorado, and North Carolina.
Where else in the U.S. is industrial hemp currently being grown that you know of?
Many places. As far as the pilot projects that got started in response to the 2014 Farm Bill, there was 30 or more states that had rules on the books, and some portion of them were able to move forward with something along the lines of commercialization or private production. I wouldn't be able to give you an exact number, but it's many folks that we're able to pay attention to and learn from.
And I guess you're probably networking with as many of those other farmers and researchers as possible, so you guys aren't all trying to invent the wheel at once.
That's right. There are way too many people for me to talk to, but part of my job, of course, is building those relationships, building that infrastructure at the university, at the state, in order to learn from others that are doing this. Absolutely.
So one of the things you said you're working on is making sure that it doesn't escape into the wild, basically. Is that more of a concern here in Florida for some reason, or is that a universal concern across, you know, all growing areas?
Well, the folks who are paying attention to environmental impacts of plant invasions or pests and diseases sort of talk in Florida on the order of the new pest or invader of the day or the new pest and invader of the week. And so anytime we find something new or we work through this process where something new can come to the state, we have to be very meticulous, very cautious, very diligent about just exactly what can happen. Now, the risk itself is not a status, right? We're using information that we have from outside of the state to demonstrate this caution, demonstrate this concern about what will happen when we bring hemp into the state. There's the follow-up step, the response to that risk, which is making sure that we clearly understand those possible areas for risk, whether it's a natural area in a specific part of the state or waterways, or areas with a lot of light, or areas with a lot of shade and moisture, those sorts of characteristics that are important for hemp ecologically, and then the various different control steps that might be important. For instance, if we have a truckload of hemp seed that's uncovered, just driving down the road and bouncing seed off into the side, there's some pretty logical things that we can do in response to that risk. We have a very clear policy at the University of Florida to make sure that we don't recommend plants for cultivation that are understood to be invasive. And so we need to make sure as a university that we're considering those issues as equally to the interesting agriculture issues that we're tackling.
Sure. Is industrial hemp in general easy to grow in terms of, you know, in other words, if it did just land somewhere, it wouldn't necessarily need help from us to propagate?
I don't have that answer for you yet. I generally demonstrate a little bit of caution, again, when folks say easy to grow. We know that there are some places around the country where you can drop it off a truck and it'll definitely grow up. We know of hemp sort of being out in the open, out naturalized in places around the world that are similar to Florida. In some ways, I've got to play both what-if games. As an agronomist, I've got to be thinking about what it takes to grow up a really strong and a quality plant for production. I don't necessarily see that as being particularly easy. These quality plants definitely require nutrition. They're definitely going to have some pests and disease issues that we need to be working to address effectively for those high-quality products. And then on the other side, the other what-if is the what just happens if a single seed goes out into a natural area of Florida. Is that going to have enough of a match to the ecosystem in order to grow up and produce some seeds, right? Those don't necessarily have to be high-quality seeds, but they just have to be quality enough to spread. And so there's those two types, parts of the story that we're trying to address, and it makes it interesting what we can learn from both sides and making sure that we're communicating effectively to both of those stakeholder groups that we're really, really working to support their concerns and their interests.
And if this, if Governor DeSantis signs this new law and farmers can proceed, they don't necessarily need to take your advice on things. They can learn from you if they want, but they won't be in any way constrained by your research and whether it's proven one way or another or anything.
I guess that's a fair statement. In one way that they would be constrained is the permitting process that would be required by the state hemp plan, likely administered by FDACs. And so, yeah, you're right. In some ways, we're going to be doing the research. We're going to be getting that best available information through our program. We certainly hope to engage with as many farmers as possible. We certainly hope to make that information available broadly so that folks can use the information that we have, whether it's positively for the agronomic outcomes or positively for making sure that we're good stewards of the environment. Ultimately, I'm not here to make demands or make, contracts of folks. The interaction that we'll have with FDACs, the interaction that the farmers will have with FDACs through the permitting process is probably the most real way with for that control step.
We chatted before the show, so I know you haven't really been working with industrial hemp for very long. Is it in a way sort of exciting to be studying something that is, blowing up around the country in terms of all the different, this is something we didn't even talk about a few years ago, and now it's being seen as maybe the next big thing in Florida agriculture.
That's right, and I get calls by radio stations and asking me to provide them information, get the information out to the public, and this is certainly exciting for me. I was brought here to the University of Florida to help establish new cropping systems from a broad agroecological perspective, one that understands the agronomic production and the environmental stewardship and the social responsibility and sort of puts that in a framework that really helps us move forward with these new industries in an effective way. And it's just super exciting to be participating in that with hemp, to have this opportunity to engage with the industry in a meaningful way and really make an impact with this work.
All right, we only have a bit left, but what's just next for your pilot project? Like, what's next on your agenda?
Sure, it's planting season. So we got those first plantings out, but we're going to be doing that throughout the summer. We're going to be gathering all that data and making sure that we can package that into some useful information. Some of that's going to be coming out in our field days that we're working to schedule this summer. So we want to be out there in the public. We want to make sure that folks choose to work with us and hear what we have to say. And so one of the ways we can do that is being transparent, inviting folks out to our research locations. And so folks who subscribe to our newsletter at our website can get those updates, can get those information, can get those invitations to these activities that we're planning throughout the year.
All right. That is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest. Dr. Zachary Brim is an assistant professor of agronomy at the UF IFAS Tropical Research and Education Center and program coordinator for the university's Industrial Hemp Pilot Project. Dr. Brim, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mike.
When we return, we're going to meet a man who moved back home to central Kentucky 5 years ago on a mission to help rebuild the U.S. hemp industry. We'll pick his brain about the hemp industry across the country and about the many ways hemp can be used, including to make CBD, which advocates say has a number of health and wellness benefits, although the science is still catching up on that. I'm Mike Canary. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. We're exploring the world of industrial hemp on today's show. There's a bill that came out of the recent legislative session that's awaiting the governor's signature that will create an industrial hemp program in the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. During the first part of the show, we learned about the University of Florida's pilot project, exploring how best to grow hemp here in the Sunshine State. But now we're going to take a step back and get a more national view on the hemp industry in this country, where it's already being grown and what it's being used to create, and that list is long and varied. Joining me now is Josh Hendricks. He's founder of Kentucky Hemp Industries Association, and he serves on the board of directors for the U.S. Hemp Roundtable, the National Hemp Association, and Friends of Hemp, and he is the director of business development domestic production for CV Sciences, which creates products containing CBD, which is one of the things industrial hemp can be turned into. Josh, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, happy to be here. Happy to be on.
And if you would like to add your voice to our conversation, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. You can make a comment or ask a question via Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Josh, before we get into the questions, I'm going to play a short interview that a reporter named Danny Rivero from WLRN in Miami recently conducted with Florida's Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried about her outlook on how important a crop in industrial hemp could become here in Florida. Let's hear that now, and then we'll get your take on it.
How do you picture the outlook for Florida's hemp industry over the next 5-10 years?
Industrial revolution. I see industrial hemp as not only the cure for our environmental issues, it uses less water, less fertilizer, it's biodegradable, actually puts nutrients back into the soil, is something that's going to be just amazing for our environment, another opportunity for an alternative crop for so many of our farmers that have been suffering from the citrus greening and Hurricane Michael and Irma, as well as the unfair trade practices from NAFTA. I'm just really excited for industrial hemp to come to the state of Florida. It's really going to be something that's going to bring jobs here to our state, economy, looking at this to be a $20 to $30 billion industry in the next 5 to 10 years. That's money that gets to go to our state for education, for affordable housing, for infrastructure, and it really is going to be something that is going to change the face of our state.
So I've talked to the owners of several cannabis-based businesses here in South Florida over the last couple weeks, and they feel that industrial hemp could bring more young people back into the agricultural sector. Do you share that vision?
Yes, absolutely. You know, some of the things that we're seeing across the state is that this generation of agriculture, the farmers, are third, fourth, fifth generations, and they're struggling. They're struggling because of all the issues that are happening not only in the state but across the country and in D.C. So giving this next generation excitement, giving them the tools to be successful, and hemp is exciting. It's new. It's fresh. They are very concerned about the environment, and knowing that they can do something that's going to contribute to the environment and protect it, I think you're going to see a lot of the next generation coming back and wanting to be a part of agriculture.
So there's been a little bit of ambiguity about whether selling CBD products is legal or illegal in the state. Can you help clarify that a little bit for us in your own view?
The FDA has retained control over the CBD productions and for human and animal consumption. And this FDA has made it very clear and made statements that it is still illegal. And then unless your state has created a CBD program, you still are operating outside the law, and have said that they're going to look at this and try to create rules and regulations, but it may take 3 years. So in our own statutes here, it says under our criminal statutes, it defines what cannabis is, and it says any derivative of the cannabis plant. So technically, the hemp plant is still considered a definition of cannabis, which is why we are moving so hard and so fast to try to get the hemp legislation passed that creates a framework for both the industrial side as well as the human animal consumption side. I mean, we all have seen, you know, how people are using CBD, and it's such a fantastic option for so many patients and consumers out there. But there's also problems. There's a lot, because there's no regulations in place, a consumer doesn't know what they're buying. They don't know if it has CBD in it. They don't know if it has THC. The last thing we want is somebody to be buying a product, think that they're just taking pure CBD, be in a drug-free workplace, get tested and test positive for THC because there was THC in the products that they were buying. And in the same respect, having no CBD, that a patient's spending money thinking that they're going to get some relief and there's no CBD in it.
The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws has warned that your office will be sending cease and desist letters to CBD retailers in the state. Have you sent any of those letters, or can you tell us if something like that is in the works right now?
That is a fake news. In fact, you know, like I have been saying from day one, once we create the program, there's going to be rules and regulations. And if you are not following those rules and regulations, then yes, law enforcement plus my office would be entitled to come in and say you must remove all these products that are not regulated, that are not part of the program, off of the shelves. There has been nothing bought from my office to test. There has been no cease and desist letters sent. There's been none that even been drafted. Again, I go back to why I want to press the bill so fast and on the hemp side, because I want to make sure we get the program in place and get the bad actors out of our state.
That was WLRN's Danny Rivero speaking with Commissioner Nikki Fried from the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. We're talking about industrial hemp on today's show. My guest on the phone is Josh Hendricks. He's founder of the Kentucky Hemp Industries Association, and he's director of business development and domestic production for CV Sciences, which makes products containing CBD and researches those products in that world. So, Josh, what are your thoughts on her predictions about how big of an industry industrial hemp could become in Florida? She made some pretty big claims there.
Lots of unwrapped there. I was actually just thinking about two-thirds of the way through, you know, this woman must have came to one of my talks, because a lot of that stuff is what I've been saying for about 4 years now, that once this really gets going and hemp becomes a commodity, the impact it can have on the environment, on the soil, on the farming community, all the way down to generations like me and below that aren't, you know, until now weren't interested or excited about their family farms. She's 100% right on all of that. One thing I don't think you mentioned, maybe it's in the bio, maybe it's not. I'm also the president of the U.S. Hemp Roundtable, and we're working very closely with states like Florida to make sure that two-pronged attack, that there is laws in place. She was a little bit incorrect about the FDA. The FDA is issued guidance, but the FDA hasn't done any enforcement and doesn't seem to plan to. I mean, I don't know that. I'm not a fortune teller, but at this point, it's a little bit hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube. So as with the U.S. Hemp Roundtable, and you can check it out at hempsupporter.com, we've been working in individual states, but we were also the group that helped get the Farm Bill language passed. In that, we have the U.S. Hemp Authority, where we are trying to provide a seal of approval to get the bad actors out and show that there are many companies around the country, such as CV Sciences, making high-quality products, going through all the proper certifications and both at the facilities and the testing on the products and all of the batch testing, and being able to take your bottle, take it to a website, put it in, and see every single test that was done on that product from the field all the way to the shelf is very important. So I think that's what the FDA is trying to wrap their head around right now, is the legality, or not the legality, but the regulations of hemp extracts. And I think, you know, I always compare it to Uber and Lyft. You know, when they started, there was no regulations on them, and the transportation boards and authorities and cities and states were going crazy trying to figure out what to do with it. They were disrupting the whole transportation industry. And now, in terms of human consumption and then obviously animal consumption down the road, we're disrupting that industry with hemp extracts. So it just has to be regulated. And what we're trying to do is do what those two organizations did when they were confronted with regulation and say, look, we've got better regulations than you do, or we're doing higher quality testing. Look at these groups that are really working towards putting quality products on the market. I think the CBD industry will flourish, and it has to, right? Right now it's driving the industry. But with that, over time, becomes the commoditization of hemp, and with that comes the materials, the food supply, with the hemp seeds and the hemp fiber to take us into a next, evolution.
Let's just go back in time a little bit. How did you wind up in this world? What made you decide that you wanted to become the Johnny Appleseed of hemp?
it's a weird story. I was in college in the mid-2000s, and my grandfather happened to be friends with a guy who was an independent politician / attorney. He never won anything, but he ran for everything in Kentucky. His name was Gatewood Galbraith, and you can look him up. He wrote a book called The Last Free Man in America, and I happened to meet him, read his book, and hang out with him through my grandfather. And in there, he talks about legalizing cannabis in general. But he was also part of the documentary Hempsters Plant the Seed with Woody Harrelson back in the 90s. And he talks about how every other industrialized nation in the world grows hemp. He speaks very much about how Kentucky used to be the leader in hemp production in terms of seed propagation for other states to grow the hemp for fiber. And I just thought, well, yeah, Kentucky's going to, we're known for horses and bourbon and basketball, we might as well add hemp back to that. We would have been the hemp state instead of the bluegrass state if this had never been outlawed. I started doing research, got really into it, and learned quickly that there was nothing you can do. Unlike marijuana, where you can legalize at the state level, hemp's a crop. It's an agricultural commodity. So to really have any kind of industry, it has to be legalized at the federal level. And everybody said, until that happens, there's nothing you can do. So I moved away, graduated college, moved away, started doing fundraising for a living, and worked 4 years later, worked for some charities in South Carolina, Richmond, Virginia. Kind of at that turning point in my life where I was trying to figure out what to do and do my own thing. I wasn't really happy with what I was doing or where I was living and all that kind of stuff. And kind of out of nowhere, hemp came back up in the news, and I was just happened to be a couple hours down the road from D.C. and just started working with groups like the Virginia Industrial Hemp Coalition and Jason Amatucci And then Jonathan Miller, who's the general counsel for the ESPN Roundtable, and now Congressman Comer, who was our ag commissioner at the time, were lobbying for the Farm Bill in D.C. and started getting involved. And the day the Farm Bill passed, I went to my boss's office and told him I was quitting to move back home and get in the hemp industry. And he said, you know, that doesn't exist. And I said, well, just wait a couple of years. So here we are.
You know, on the first part of the show, we were learning about the University of Florida's pilot project, you know, exploring how best to grow it here in the state. Did Kentucky do anything similar? Or, you know, who have you been learning from?
Well, so, you know, being that Kentucky was the reason that this legislation passed, Kentucky was the first one to establish the pilot programs. That first year, we had more pilot programs, but less acreage than Colorado. Now it's kind of flip-flop. Colorado's gone full gangbusters, and we're not a close second, but the two of us are the top producing states now. But so it went from, you know, 30-something acres to, I think we've approved over 10,000 acres, or 20,000 acres, I'm sorry, in Kentucky this year for production. And so through that, there's a lot of work with companies like myself or CV Sciences have done with the University of Kentucky and Murray State and Kentucky State. We've also done some projects up in Pennsylvania with the Rodale Institute for Organic Agriculture. Really just trying to get this, you know, we haven't grown this crop in 75 years. I caught a little bit of that interview before, and, you know, there is, like you said, there's the seed that can fall out of the truck that can grow feral, but that's not really how you grow a crop and produce you know, good yields and things like that. So we're really trying to get the right seeds in the right locations and the right soil to really produce the yields that these farmers need to get back to where they can afford these farms that they live on.
Can you talk some about the benefits of hemp environmentally speaking? You know, it was alluded to during the Commissioner Freed interview, and we talked a little bit about it earlier. But in terms of, like, what it would be replacing, I understand it's just better for the environment, maybe less water use, and, you know, it helps replenish the soils, apparently. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so hemp is probably, I believe, something that, if done right, we could use to really change the direction we've been heading agriculturally. You know, we've been heavy chemicals and depletion of soil methods for a long time now, but most people. And what hemp actually does is it remediates the soil. So it's, as it's growing, and you're not going to grow human consumption type products and soil that you're trying to remediate, but you can grow fibrous materials, you know, the dashboard of your car, the door panel, anything that's plastic or fiberglass or anything like that. That material can obviously be, that type of growing, fiber production can be used for soil remediation. So we can start to clean up some other soil, and then you start rotating other crops in there, and you start to get back to that organic, almost bioremediation type of agriculture. So yes, 100% correct. On all fronts, even when you're growing it in quality soil, using less resources, hopefully, because we haven't, you know, the benefit of it being illegal for 75 years is that there's never been any chemicals approved to be sprayed on hemp in the United States. So we kind of have to use organic methods to get going right now, and hopefully we'll take this opportunity to create organic fertilizers and pesticides and things like that for the hemp plant and start to transition back from that nasty, Monsantized version of farming to a more earth, soil-friendly method.
We got a question on Twitter from Vic. Do pollinating insects like hemp, and does industrial hemp require pesticides? I think you kind of just alluded to that. You know, what about pollinating insects and the use of pesticides?
Yeah, so I definitely would Google that if I were them, just because there's so much information about that. But definitely bees, lots of bees. You know, my grandfather, I joke around, he's a bee serial killer because he can't seem to get it right. But once we started growing hemp on the farm, even just the natural bees, and you see them everywhere. So definitely a yes on that front. And then on the pesticides, I mean, you know, it ideally no, but that's not really realistic. The idea is that with anything, you're trying to increase yields and decrease costs. So if you could grow without pesticides, great, but I've grown hemp and, there's certain things and certain pests that even certain, mainly weed pressure, some herbicides, that we need to deal with. And there's some natural ways to do that with sorghum and some different stuff. But there's also ways to create organic fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides that we can utilize on organic farms and start to shift that conversation too. So I wouldn't say no, but I wouldn't rule it out that you can get away with no pesticides and perfect conditions, but you know, Mother Nature's a fickle mistress, as I like to say. So not always what happens.
We are exploring the world of industrial hemp and CBD on today's show. We're going to pivot to CBD next here. My guest during this segment is Josh Hendricks. He is founder of the Kentucky Hemp Industries Association, and he is director of business development and domestic product production for CV Sciences, which makes products containing CBD. Have you used CBD? If so, for what? And what effect has it had? If you have a story to share, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So tell us about CV Sciences. You guys, that company both researches CBD effects and is creating some products that are available. Is that a correct assessment?
Oh, yeah. I was actually thought you were asking me that question a minute ago. I was like, about to be like, oh, what a softball. Hell,
oh, yeah. No, CBD, no. Sorry. Yeah.
I've not been interrupted you there. But so CBD scientists could say that, yeah, we create some products would be an understatement. We're the top, plus CBD oil, our main line is the top CBD retail brand in the country right now. And I think we just announced last week when I was out of the country that we did almost $15 million in sales in the first quarter of this year. So, you know, that's on top of doing, I believe, 48 last year total. So you can see the growth there, and then you see the store count start to grow. You see that we're, you know, about to be in CVS and places like that. And I joke around about the first time that I went to a company out, I guess 3 years ago, and everyone was talking about how we had just had our first $1 million month. And my boss came up to me and he said, you don't seem as excited about this. I know you live in Kentucky, we're out here in California, and you're kind of removed from this, but you know, what's the deal? And I said, I don't know. I just like to think big picture and futuristic. I said, you know, I'm just laughing because there'll be a time not very far from now when if we only do $1 million in a month, we'll all be out of a job. And he really liked that because he liked the fact that I saw this thing that was going to happen and really revolutionize the way we look at health. And so, yeah, CBD Sciences makes products plus CBD oil. One of the top brands. We have three different versions of that line. One's kind of an herbal aspirin. It's our raw product, our green, which, and then there's a raw topical that's really more for itchy, dry, that kind of stuff, skin. And then we have our green product, which is kind of an everyday supplement, everyday stress, and, you know, life is hard, and people like to use supplements for mood support and things like that. And then our gold line, which is just really a little bit of an extra strength kind of version for people that are really trying to alleviate something or deal with something they maybe something nagging them for a long time, something with a name or something they've definitely had some trouble with over the years, or just maybe they need a little bit more CBD to balance out their endocannabinoid system than most. So, you know, I think, you know, getting people to understand that we all have an endocannabinoid system, and if you're not using any kind of cannabis, you're not getting any kind of cannabinoids. So you have to do that, you know, internally, you have to really be, you know, very mentally, physically well. And not all of us are. We've all lived kind of crazy lives with chemicals and fatty foods and terrible workout regimes and things like that. So trying to help people balance that out is kind of why we do what we do. And so through that, it's a long way to answer your question, is we're also one of the largest supporters of research clinical trials for CBD and what does it actually do. You know, people told me to tell all the things that people told me CBD does for them, you'd think I was crazy. But we're starting to get some real science behind it. You can go to PubMed.gov and search CBD and pretty much anything these days, and there's studies being done. And, you know, to put that in perspective, 4 years ago there was like 172 studies on CBD, and I think now there's like 170,000 something that have happened or in progress. So it's kind of crazy.
You know, the endocannabinoid system that you just alluded to, we talked about it recently on the show with a professor here at FGCU who studies, you know, toxicology and chemistry and the brain and the body and all that stuff. And it's really fascinating that we didn't really even know that existed until about 25 years ago. And it's basically in all humans and all mammals, as I understand it.
Well, you know, a lot of people, the easiest way to explain it to them is if you've ever had that runner's high, as people refer to it, where maybe it's a workout, maybe it's just a really amazing life experience or something where you got the endorphins pumping and you're like, man, I feel great. But you're not high. You're not intoxicated, right? That just means your body's functioning and hitting on all cylinders. It means your endocannabinoid system, your body's producing cannabis-like compounds. But really, can make you, as I like to say, kind of achieve your human potential and really be your best self. You know, a lot of people have daily stresses, and, you know, life is hard. I mean, we live in a world where it's crazy. And People have families and kids and bills and all this stuff. So we'd be lying to ourselves if anybody said their life was perfect. So some people may not need CBD or hemp extracts, as I like to refer to it. But some people could use a lot of it. And then there's everything in between. I have a radio show myself called the Hemp Happy Hour podcast, whatever. But I had a doctor on our show, Dr. Michael Lewis, and he said, you know, Josh, you've got to think about it this way. If you have this system and you know that it can be in balance, because none of us, you know, hemp's been out of our diet forever, and none of us consume cannabis unless illegally until recently, and now that's becoming a different thing that's more intoxicating, has very different effects. He said, if I told you you could spend a couple dollars a day on a couple, you know, however many sprays or pills or whatever, CBD, and it would improve your quality of life 10 or 15%, would you do it? And I said, well, yeah, sure, because maybe I'd make 10 or 15% more money and have 10 or 15% better relationships and friendships and just quality of life. And he was like, the reality is most people are having 20, 30, 50, 70% quality of life improvements from taking CBD and finding out how much they need per day to feel balanced. And he was like, think about how many people buy a pack of cigarettes or a Diet Coke or a Big Mac or whatever it is, and they think it's going to give them energy or make them feel better or whatever. It's just a, you know, almost like being a glutton for punishment. This is the opposite of that. So that's how we got to get people to think about this. Not that it's going to save the world or cure everything or whatever, but that it can help you be a more balanced individual and really live a better quality of life.
We only have a few seconds left, but, you know, things have moved so fast in this country over the past few years, especially here in Florida, which seemed like it was going to be a longer haul than it's been. You know, did you see that coming? I guess you did. I mean, you kind of alluded to that. You saw this coming.
I kept going around and I just kept telling people at these conferences and talks I would give. I would say, you know, I think about it all the time. It crossed my mind all the time. The government, back when we were fighting the Farm Bill, the DEA. All right, we won that battle. What's next? The FDA. But the reality is, you know, we're on the right side of history here. There's not a negative thing you can find about hemp. It's good for the soil. It's good for the environment. It's good for the farmer. It's good for the economy. It's going to create jobs and companies like CB Sciences that are going to create, you know, economics, scaling economics and things like that. And it's good for the consumer, you know. I mean, it's good for the retailer. There's really not a negative you can find. And so just, you know, dealing with this change and dealing with disruption, it just seems like a no-brainer to me. Now, you know, you never know with the government how things play out.
Right, right.
That's very obvious about that. But things have moved fast, and I think we're moving in the right direction, and I'm really excited about it.
All right, that is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Josh Hendricks, is founder of the Kentucky Hemp Industries Association, and he serves on the board of directors for the U.S. Hemp Roundtable, the National Hemp Association, and Friends of Hemp, and he's director of business development and domestic production for CV Sciences. Josh, thank you so much for your time and your insights into this new world of industrial hemp and CBD.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
If you missed part of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, gulfcoastlive.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. We got help today from Tara Callaghan. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.